You're listening to the Raising Empowered Humans series here on the Chat About Children podcast. Let's chat.
Discover children at a whole new level. Be empowered to grow with the children in your life. Welcome to Chat About Children with Sonia Bestelich.
Thank you for joining me for this very special series, the Raising Empowered Humans series. The intention of this series is to share powerful conversations with heart-led leaders, entrepreneurs, experts, innovators, and imaginators who share their stories, philosophies, practices, and principles when it comes to raising empowered humans. This series aims to inspire and energize parents, carers, and professionals who work with children to leave a legacy of raising children who are of highest service to themselves and to the world. Now, I do welcome you to sign up to my newsletter at soniabestelich.com for transformative tips, tools, and strategies to help you be more empowered in raising empowered humans. Let's get this episode started. I have the absolute pleasure of Paul Sullivan joining me today. He is the founder of the Company of Dads, the first platform dedicated to creating a community for lead dads. He's a lead dad himself, of course, and he's on a mission to help other lead dads feel less isolated and more confident that they've made the right choice to take on the bulk of the parenting and family duties, or at the very least, not embrace those stereotypes around who does what at home. Now, before starting the Company of Dads in 2021, Paul wrote the Wealth Matters column in the New York Times for 13 years, and he created the Money Game column in Golf magazine. As a journalist for 25 years, his articles have appeared widely across a range of global publications, including Fortune and Money. Paul is also the author of two books. One's called Clutch, Why Some People Excel Under Pressure and Others Don't. And the other is The Thin Green Line, The Money Secrets of the Super Wealthy. Now, when Paul's not running the Company of Dads or being a lead dad, he is an obsessive golfer. Paul, welcome to the Chat About Children podcast and to the Raising Empowered Human series.
I should just stop now. I feel like that was such a kind, sweet intro. I was like, thank you very much. Goodbye.
We'll leave it there. Yes, it's a bit like that. You've done some cool stuff and you're doing cool stuff, Paul. How about I just launch in and say you're an empowered human yourself. How have you kind of found your why in life? How did you come to know that and to live it and breathe it and be it?
You know, like most important things in life, by accident. I mean, how do we really design all this stuff? It's by accident. It's, you know, my dream growing up in a very rural part of the state of Massachusetts in the United States was to write for the New York Times, which was a crazy, crazy dream because I didn't know anybody who wrote for the New York Times. I don't know if I even know anybody who read the New York Times. And it worked out. And it was amazing. And by the time I got there, I sold my first book, standing in the newsroom of the Times, the business section. I was off to the races. I married a wonderful woman. We had one daughter. Then we had a second daughter. That first book led to keynote talks. And I was like thinking, this can't get any better. This is like is like, I didn't imagine this. And my wife comes to me and just says, you know, I want to start my own business. My wife works in financial services. And I said, do it. Like, you're great. Like, I'm not going to tell you not to do it. Like, this is amazing. And she said, you know, but one thing you might get mad at me. He's like, why did I get mad at you? It's a great idea. I'm going to tell my boss tomorrow that in 3 months, I'm going to leave, start my own business. I'm going to take my clients. He's going to keep his clients. I said, you're right. This is a horrible idea. A horrible idea. She said, no, he'll understand. I said, no, he will not understand. He is not an empowered human. I didn't know that phrase, but he's not an empowered human. She said, no, you're being too harsh. I was like, come on, you know, give me a break. He forced his final child to go off to boarding school so he could divorce their mother and marry his girlfriend. He is not a good human being. He's not an empowered human being. And of course, what happened was what, you know, anybody would imagine happening, which was when she told him, let's do this for the good of the clients, he promptly fired her and refused to pay her. And it was miserable. And so she started the business the next day, and she said, what are we going to do with the girls? We have three girls now. We had two then. And she said, I'll become the lead dad. And she said, what does that mean? And I said, I have no idea, but is this really a time to panic? I mean, let's be honest here. And that's the by accident part. And what it meant was I was at a stage in my career where I had a lot of control over my time, over my schedule. Like I could maybe control 80% of my week. And, you know, a column is due same day every week. If I'm doing an edited special section, you know, and that is books take 2 years to write. Nobody ever calls you up and says, can you fly to, you know, Vegas in 3 days to give a keynote talk? Everything is planned out. And I was able to do it, and nobody cared, and it worked. And I loved it, but I wasn't honest about it because in my town, you know, I didn't see a lot of other. So a lot of other guys who looked exactly like me, a lot of other bald white guys who love playing golf, but I didn't see a lot of other guys who looked exactly like me caring for their two young daughters. I saw a lot of moms doing that. I saw a lot of paid caregivers doing that, you know, nannies, au pairs, babysitters. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to keep this one to myself. And it worked fine until COVID. And then in COVID, it didn't work because all of this being a lead dad was, you know, I wasn't a stay-at-home dad. I was, and we at the company dads, we call that person a lead dad who devotes all of his time to his family. You know, nobody's really staying at home. You're doing a lot of stuff, but I was a lead dad who worked full time and it didn't work in COVID. And I thought, shit, this is not good. What am I going to do? And so I did what anybody would do during a global pandemic in search of information. I went to the Google. I said, the Google knows everything. It is like an ancient Greek oracle. It will enlighten me. And yes. It did not enlighten me. It showed me that there's a lot of stuff out there for moms. And all the stuff for parents is really for moms. And all the stuff for dads is very niche for dads in some form of distress. And that started me along this journey to say, like, okay, how many lead dads are there in the United States? Turns out there are a ton. There are about 25 million men in the U.S. who are or could be lead dads. That's a third of all fathers. Then it got me to, you know, reach out to senior female executives. What do you think of this idea? Some of them really loved it. Some of them said, this is necessary. You know, my husband isn't pulling his share. I don't think he's really an ally of women in the workplace. And then there's a third group who said, good luck. I hope you can save marriages because I got divorced because my husband could never wrap his head around this. And so I was like, okay. And then it was this last conversation I had is like, you know, my mindset was like, write a book. But this final conversation I had with this woman, and she said, this isn't a book. This is, you know, summer of 2021. This is a media company community platform. And I said, she was right. But then I knew like, that's hard. That's really hard to do. Like I worked for the New York Times, which is a global, you know, media company. Doing niche media is hard. But workplace education, I knew there was a need because I'd written these books, I'd given these talks. And so that's those three things. And so in October 21, I wrote my final column in the New York Times, which is amazing. It was gracious of them to ask me to do it. And we launched a company Dads in 2022. And we do the three things we set out to do. And then that's media, community, and workplace education. And you know, although we're focused on lead dads, our tagline is really helping families fulfill their full potential. And we think about that at home, in their community, and in the workplace.
Yes, I love that. And I love that whole origin story and how it came to be. And you really kept your cool by the sounds of this, Paul, amongst all of that. You've just gone, yeah, let's just roll with it. Give me a surfboard, I'm riding the waves. Is that how it really was?
Of course not. And anybody who tells you that, they're just lying. Like, of course not. There was the initial like elation. It's like, you know, I left the Times and the great column, the tons of, you know, feedback and all this came in. I'm like, this is great. And then I promptly hire somebody who completely fleeces me out of a ton of money to build the beta version of the Company of Dads. I'm like, huh, that's not good. And then I, you know, make a couple of mistakes along the way, but there's so much goodwill in that first year that I'm really floating. I'm like, this is great. You know, we're acquiring, you're building this audience. We're reaching out to company leaders. And then in year two, I was like, okay, you know, what's the business here? And there was one point I'd hired this guy who promised to do, you know, all kinds of things. And anybody who starts a story off like that, I hired this guy who promised to do all kinds of things. It's going to end with, he did not do all those things that he promised to do. And I let him go on, wait for it, company dads. When do you let somebody go? On Father's Day. I'm like, man, this is it. Like, that's how we do it. that's like, you know, the sort of the godfather version of the company of dads. Like all the bad stuff comes down on Father's Day. But then I had like last summer, I was like, this is like the summer of my discontent. Like, what in the world have I done? Like, what kind of dumbass leaves the New York Times to start this, to take this flyer? And I was like, boy, this is not great. And I remember, I'll never forget this. Like, I used to love the month of August, you know, the August in our hemisphere. It's summertime, we're outside relaxing. And I didn't really have to work that hard in August, you know, do a couple things. And that's because everyone was on vacation. This past August, I was like, typing away, like, how do I reach people? How do I get people? No, why is nobody responding? I'm like, nobody is responding because they're on vacation. They don't want to hear from me. And I was like, boy, what am I going to do? And then just, I don't know if it's luck. I don't know if it was just, we'd been producing a lot of content. I'd been, you know, I tapped into something that was really resonating. And all of a sudden in the fall, like this faucet, you know, turned on and we suddenly had all these partnerships. We had these great companies reaching out to us. We had a steady stream of revenue. And then I was like, okay, you know, this is the idea that I thought was needed in this moment of time. And fortunately, other people who have money to pay me to keep doing this believe that this idea is needed at this moment of time. But
yes.
So it was 100% not any sort of straight ascent. There was a moment where I was like, God, you dumb Sullivan, what did you do?
Thank you for sharing that and being vulnerable. So in that journey, you know, I'm visualizing your family and your daughters, and I'm wondering, Paul, what were they learning? What were the lessons they were learning, do you think, from what you were experiencing in that time in terms of what you were role modeling to them and for them? What do you feel that they absorbed? And they may have shared what they did, or maybe you observed, but I'd love to learn more about that.
My girls are 6, 11, and 14. My older girls were very proud of me, but they'd already seen entrepreneurship through their mom. Like my wife, you know, started her own firm in 2013. She's been very successful, but they've also seen the ups and downs. Like, you know, a good year doesn't lead to a better year, doesn't lead to a better year. Like you can have the greatest year and the next year is awful. And so we'd already gotten used to that ebb and flow.
Yes.
The one thing that was different is that in the very beginning, when I was launching it, as you'd launch anything, you want to pour all your time and energy into something that you're passionate about. But you can't start something called the Company of Dads in support of lead dads, you know, looking to help all families fulfill their full potential. And then one, neglect your children, and two, forget about your wife. And I remember years ago, I interviewed Pierre Omidyar, who's one of the founders of eBay. And I don't know what he's worth now, $20, $30, $40 million. But, you know, he essentially told me, he said, you know, I don't know, I'm a pretty rich guy, but back when he's worth a mere like $8 billion, he said, you know, I worked really hard for 3 years. I didn't have any vacations. I didn't see anybody. And then eBay came out and it did really well. And I was like, you can't do that. You can't do that starting something called the Company of Dads. And so I had to think differently. But a lot of the ways I was thinking, because like a column, writing a column for the New York Times is very predictable. Like,
yes.
You know, like, you're going to, you know, make some calls on these days, more calls on these days. You're going to write it this day. Somebody's going to edit it. Then you're going to kind of touch it up on the fifth day. And then you start all over. Very predictable. Being an entrepreneur in any sense is not predictable. So I was like, okay, if I want companies to change the way they think about employees, not just lead dads, not just working moms, but caregivers in general, I have to model that behavior. I can't be a hypocrite. I can't be a hypocrite.
Yeah.
And, you know, do one thing, you know, say one thing and do another. And so I started working what we call the company that's a care shift. And a care shift is, you know, here it's about, you know, 9 to 3. Every day, 9 to 3, I am working when the majority of people in the United States are working synchronously. But that doesn't mean I just work a 6-hour day. It means that's the time when I'm available for synchronous conversations. And then I send the emails, I work on the presentations, I do some of the writing, I do that early in the morning before my kids are up, I do that at night when everyone's going to bed. You know, we are doing this podcast now at 9 p.m. My time in the United States. And that's fine because my youngest daughter's in bed, you know, my other two daughters are going to bed, and it works. And so I started doing things in my own business that I wanted other businesses, much larger, much bigger, more financially successful businesses to adopt. And so when they say, well, what are you doing? I'm doing this. And then they would always come back to me and say, okay, well, you know, Sullivan, what do you know? You can do this. I say, well, actually, I got this idea from a guy named David Booth. And I'm like, well, who's David Booth? And I said, have you ever heard of the University of Chicago? I went to the University of Chicago for graduate school. And I'm like, yeah, great, great university. Like, well, the business school is named after David Booth. You don't get a business school named after you by being a really nice guy and showing up at your reunion. You get a business school named after you by donating tens and tens, probably $100 million. I don't know how much he donated. And he runs a fund, an investment firm. And he realized early on that instituting his own version of a care shift was much more productive for his workers. And this is not a nonprofit guy. This is an ultimate for-profit guy. And it's made people, you know, be, at the very least, they've been able to be more honest with themselves and each other. They don't have to lie and say, I'm going to go pick up my kid or take a call on the car line. They could just say, hey, my care shift is done at 3 o'clock. I'll log back on at 4:30 and we'll be fine. And so, you know, to bring it back, I mean, that was, you know, my daughter saw me working hard, but it's really, you know, modeling for those other people when, you know, I'd have calls like this, like what you and I are doing now. And I could say, like, this is what we're doing. Like, we are walking the walk and we're talking the talk.
Yes, 100%. So how would you define, Paul, what raising an empowered human actually means?
You know, I had this great guy on one of the features we have called the Lead Dad of the Week. And this guy, his name is Clint Bruce. And Clint Bruce went to the U.S. Navy Academy. Then he played in the NFL, played professional football. And he left to become a Navy SEAL, which in the United States is the sort of most elite fighting force we have. And Clint is, you know, a giant, you know, 280 pounds, a giant man. And he has this phrase that he used, he has three daughters. And he says, you know, hard now, easy later, easy now, hard later. And it really encapsulated a lot of what we do. Like, we're very fortunate to live in a really nice neighborhood, a nice house and a nice town outside of New York City. Everything's really nice. Like there's not, and that can sometimes be bad. And so we started thinking, like, what are our daughters going to do? And so they have a set of chores. Like, you know, the deal is there's a book we read to them when they were kids called The Little Red Hen. And The Little Red Hen is all about this hen that bakes a pie and nobody else, and the other animals don't help the little red hen. And then they want to eat the pie. And the little red hen essentially says, screw you. You didn't help me and eat the whole pie herself, which is awesome. And so we think, so like, whoever cooks the dinner in our house, so either my wife or me generally, is not cleaning up. And whoever's cooking the dinner is also not setting the table. Somebody else is going to clear the table. Somebody else is going to wash the dishes. Now, this isn't often too arduous. We have a dishwasher. So you rinse them off, put them in there. But there are pots and pans. And that's the routine. You know, we have three dogs. Every night, somebody's feeding those dogs breakfast. Somebody's feeding those dogs dinner. Somebody's going out in our yard and picking up the poop. Because three dogs, they poop. They poop a lot. And it didn't an unending supply. And so it's little things like that. It's like, you know, could we put their clothes away for them? Of course we could. But what is that going to teach them? You know, my oldest daughter will enter, you know, high school in the United States. So she's going to ninth grade next year. And so this is the summer when she's going to start doing her own laundry. Just is what it is. Could I keep doing her laundry? Of course I could. It's not that hard. But like, how is she going to learn? You know, she's a great baker. She'll bake stuff for us. But, you know, once a month, the oldest one will cook us dinner. The 11-year-old is now, you know, learned how to make eggs. So she makes herself eggs in the morning. So it's like, you know, sometimes we do too much for kids because we think that that shows love. We think that if we can remove obstacles, we're making their lives easier than our lives were. But what we're doing is, it's back to that phrase, hard now, easy later, easy now, hard later. We're setting them up for failure, you know, later on. And so in no way are we running any sort of like Navy SEAL boot camp in my house. So don't get me wrong here, but we are saying like, okay, these are your responsibilities and this is what you have to do. And, you know, for the most part, they don't really protest because they know that's how they contribute to being part of the family.
It's an ecosystem of collaboration and contribution. Mm-hmm. That's how I kind of summarize it. Which is really beautiful. And I think what you've described is you've always got that choice of, if you're doing something for them, that's leaning toward the disempowerment side of the spectrum. And you're teaching them and guiding them and how to do it and supporting them, saying, I'm here. If anything, you know, kind of goes in the wrong direction or an unplanned direction, I'm here to support and guide, lead them to that empowerment side of the spectrum. Wondering how your family can flourish without the sacrifice of your health, wealth, and dreams? Empowering a family to flourish is both an art and a science, and I'm super excited to have packaged decades of expertise to create the Flourishing Families program for you. It's time to shift the energy of your family ecosystem with more fun, more freedom, and more fulfillment. Head over to soniabeslich.com and sign up now. You know, you've mentioned some routines that your family and philosophies that you guys engage in. Do you feel that there are other kind of a value system that you have had to explicitly go through with your children? Has it just been through osmosis, through this is just how we roll? This is a question that comes up for people who try to
teach
when sometimes it's like, let's model, let's embody, and let's show that way. What have you found?
You can talk all you want, and it's really irrelevant to your children. They watch everything you do. So, you know, years ago, this guy named Jim Grubman, he's a counselor to a lot of generationally connected families, and he does this exercise around gratitude. And we talk a lot about gratitude, and it's become kind of a platitude, but gratitude is essential in the real, you know, meaning of the word. And it's like, how do you give somebody a tip? You know, you walk into a hotel and you want to give somebody, you know, some money for carrying your suitcase in and all that. How do you do it? And it's so crucial, because he would go with wildly successful people, and some of them would be very dismissive. They would sort of, you know, hand the money and be looking over here at the same time. And he says, no, if you're going to give somebody a tip, you need to hand it to them, shake their hand, and look them in the eye. And they're like, well, why does that matter? You know, he still gets $20, $100, whatever. It's like, it matters for all the people who are watching you. Because when you go up later on and say, well, why is my kid such a brat? Why is my kid so entitled? Why does my kid appreciate things? Well, your child has been watching you the entire time. And so, you know, you talked about grades, and we have been very clear from the beginning. We live in this, you know, hyper-competitive part of suburban New York where, you know, it's sort of Harvard or bust. And, you know, Harvard only accepts so many people every year. And that's just, you know, how much you want. And, you know, people are grade obsessed here around the kids. And so what we've said instead is like, okay, you know, if you get an A on that exam, great. You knew all the material. You studied really hard. If you got a B or a C on that exam, well, I guess you didn't know the material as well. You know, where do you think you can study a bit more? And quite honestly, you know, Sonia, one of my hopes for all of my girls is that they take a class in school while they're still at home and they do horribly. Like, I really want them to do horribly, because at some point in their life, that's going to happen. And that happened to me in my first year of college. Like, I kind of sailed through school as, you know, bright kid, you know, financial aid, scholarships, and all this. And I got to college and I took this calculus course that was way above my head. And I was like, holy moly. Like, I think that's the end of mathematics for me. And I got through it, and I worked really hard, but like, that was the first real moment of a setback. But I would, you know, what a gift if my daughters could have that setback here and we could talk it through. But that all comes from modeling. They never see, you know, my wife and I say, oh yeah, you know, do your best. And then they get a grade and you're like, what? You got three answers wrong? What? Go to your room. No dessert for a month. And so it's keeping, like, so many things in life, if you're raising enlightened humans, if you want to be an enlightened human being yourself, it's about consistency. Because you can just talk, but if they're not seeing you model this behavior yourself, then they're not going to buy it. And then they're also, the worst part, they're not going to trust you. When something really serious happens, you don't have that reservoir of trust that's built up because you don't deserve it. You haven't earned it.
Yeah. Thank you. Super powerful. You know, as you were speaking, I was thinking about my own children. And when they've kind of said, oh, I got my results back for whatever, my practice is being very, very neutral, as in I'll just go, are you happy with that? You know, as in, are they happy with it? How did you go in terms of prepping for it? Like, I'm bringing it back to their own measure, and because they know. And I was like, you guys know the truth within yourselves. If you gave it 100%, then and at the end of the day, if you did and you're not so happy with your score, it's just feedback. It's just feedback. It just tells you where you need to and polish up or study more or whatever you want to do. Yeah. So that's kind of been my approach so far. And as well as sharing my own stories of, hey, I failed this exam and this is what I did. And, you know, because sometimes they use the excuse, oh, my teacher's not. I'm like, I don't hear about your teacher.
So, you know, I got to maintain credibility with the years. So I'll tell you a story. So, you know, the United States is famous for all these, you know, sports parents who are on the sidelines, you know, thinking their kids are going to go to the Olympics. That's not me. Yeah. But my daughter, who's 11, is in this English class, and they're learning all this vocabulary, and she's really struggling. And so I was like, huh. I was like, all right, well, just, you know, and she has dyslexia. And so I call up the teacher and I say, how do you do this? And like, oh, we do these definitions, do this. And I was like, okay, well, you know, looked at some of the definitions, are kind of long. Well, this is what we do. I was like, all right. And it keeps going. And I'm thinking the teacher may, you know, find a different way to teach beyond like rote memorization. Like this is 2024, like rote memorization should be passe. And she won't do it. And so then I like, God, I get pissed off. And so I was like, I look at the definitions. And I was like, let me go again to the Google, to the Greek Oracle of our time. Let me go to the Google. And I type in the definition. And the teacher has essentially ripped off every definition from Merriam-Webster. Like, and so you have an 11-year-old kid, you know, she's 5 years, 11-year-old kid. And you know, the word is brio or the word is panache. These are fun words, but the definition is 15 words long. And the poor kid is trying to memorize that. And I said, you know, I said, screw that shit. I became the sideline parent. I'm like, give me these things. And so I write down three-word definitions for everything. He's like, Daddy, can I do this? And I'm like, your daddy was a New York Times columnist. I know what the fuck I'm talking about here. And so I write down all the words. She gets a 98 in the test. The next one, she gets 100. I'm like, screw you, crappy teacher. And so like, let's not like, but it was just like the teacher, her methods were so like 30 years old. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. And this kid is trying as hard as she can. How can I empower her? How can I show her this? And I told the story and I'm pretty proud of it. I was like the sideline parent. And now we do the car. And she knows all these great words now because I gave her like normal definitions that, you know,
as that made sense. Become
adults, that makes sense. As we become adults, we don't sit around defining words. We know how to use them in context. Yeah. We can use an analogy to tell what the word is about. And it was like, so at that point I was, but the teacher, not a good teacher. So what are you going to do?
Well, I love that story, but yes, and that's exactly where I was going. Like when I've heard one of my kids kind of go, oh, you know, no one likes the teacher, the teacher's blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, don't use the teacher though as your excuse. Like if you're struggling with something, we'll work out another way. But don't use her or him as the scapegoat. Like you've kind of acknowledged, this is not working.
Is that working?
No. Right, it's not working. But you've given an alternate, right? And so some kids, though, will go, my teacher's crap. Therefore, that gives me permission to just do crap in all my tests, right? So that's one avenue. Right. The empowered avenue is what you've just described. That's what we're aiming for. Yeah. What's an alternate?
It was good fun.
Yeah. So as we're kind of getting to the end of this chat, Paul, I can't let you go until we dive into the question of advice when it comes to wealth. You know, and perhaps you can draw on your book that shares the money secrets of the super wealthy. And I'm wondering, from what you've learned from your writing of that book, and you know, looking at the family ecosystem and the whole empowerment spectrum, if you like, how does that all marry up? Tell us more.
Yeah, wealth, money, saving—it's all really easy if we're honest with ourselves. Because there are only four things you can do with money, no matter how much or little money you have. There are only four things you can do with money. You can save it, you can spend it, you can give it away, and you can think about it. You can't do anything else. There's nothing else you can do with money. Save it, spend it, give it away, think about it. And too often, all kinds of psychological baggage comes in because money becomes a substitute for worth, for self-worth, for net worth, or personal accomplishment. Money is just a means of exchange. More money, more choices. Less money, not so many choices. That's it. And I often talk about money as gasoline. If you are fortunate enough to have a lot of money, if you're fortunate enough to have a lot of gasoline, you can drive your car a really, really long way, or you can light yourself on fire. And so that's what can happen in this. And so what often happens in the discussion around money is we get too much into like, what does it mean to us? What do I want? And there are simple ways to do it. My second book, The Thin Green Line. The Thin Green Line is essentially, if you envision any stock market in the world since the 1980s, it's generally gone up. On the top of that line, the stock market line, are people who I call wealthy. On the bottom are people who are rich. And people are like, well, what's the difference between wealthy and rich? That doesn't make any sense. It makes all the sense in the world. People who are rich don't have choices because they're highly levered. They spend too much money. They don't think holistically about it. People who are wealthy, they could be a school teacher. They could be a nurse. They could also be a hedge fund billionaire or CEO of a company. But they're wealthy because they've made different choices. And once you can make the choices that you want to make, you'll feel empowered. And I always say, you know, there's so many personal finance books that say, like, if you don't go to Starbucks and spend $5 a day on a coffee, and you put that $5 into bank account every day for 365 days, you will have X amount of dollars in the end. And then they run compound interest. And you look at that number, you're like, staggering. And it's 100% true, but it's not how we want to live our lives. A better way to do it is to reverse engineer it and say, okay, I think I need to have X amount of dollars. And that means, you know, making this up every year, I need to put $100,000 aside or $50,000 aside or $15,000, whatever the number is. And you do that. And then you have some money left over and you're like, well, I should have some fun. I should enjoy my life. Because what happens is too many people get on this sort of money diet. And we all know this. I mean, everyone's been guilty of this. January 1st, new year, new me. I'm going to eat better. I'm going to exercise every day. I'm going to go buy a stationary bike for $1,000. I'm going to go buy a Peloton. You know, that was Peloton. So like, buy a Peloton. That'd be great. And then you don't use it. Then like after 2 or 3 months, like, ah, screw that. I'm going to go drink a beer. Because you went all in. If you find a level of moderation, you can keep it going. And that's what we advise. And you know, when you have couples, I mean, again, it comes back to honesty with them, honesty with yourself, and just transparency. Like, what is important to us? And not say like, I can't believe you spent X on this. Well, you spent Y on that. That's a route to ruin. It's okay. We've agreed that we are going to save this amount of money every year. And then here are our expenses. Okay, we got that done. And now we have this amount left over. How do we want to spend it? Well, maybe you take a little bit, I'll take a little bit, and then why don't we spend the rest of it together? And that's the road to happiness. But it's all about moderation and communication.
Yeah, absolutely. And so how did you help us visualize how the whole wealth money ecosystem works within your family dynamics with your kids specifically?
So my kids, for years now, they've gotten allowance each week that is not tied to them doing anything. And that's on purpose. They have to do things around the house because nobody pays me to take the garbage out. You know, nobody pays me, you know, to walk the dogs. And so those are things you have to do as a member of the household. But when you give people, kids, an allowance, and they get $1 for every year, so $14, $11, $6, and I give it to them in dollar bills, which as they get older, they get annoyed. But they have a piggy bank that this woman, Susan Beecham, created, and it's called the Money Savvy Pig. So it looks like a pig, and it's divided up into four different things. You can, save money, spend money, invest, so longer term savings, and then donate, I think is the last one. And they have to put money in the pig. And that's what they get. And it's really helped them think about money. Now, the oldest one is at an age where she can start, you know, babysitting and earn some money. And so with that, and she has a bank account. So with that, it's like, okay, some portion, you know, every couple of months needs to go into the bank account. And then you have this other amount. And for the most part, she's pretty good at saving, but I don't tell her if she wants to buy something that a, you know, 14-year-old teenage girl would buy. I don't say don't do that, because she needs the experience of either having the satisfaction of buying something or the regret of buying something. And so just today, they didn't have school. And so I picked her up in town with a friend, and she said, I got to start branching out and babysitting. And I said, well, I'm broke. And she showed me what she bought. I'm like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. Like, what are you going to do? Like, this is, but it's a lesson that's sinking in. And there's certain things that we will pay. Like, if they go into town with their friends and they're going to get lunch, I'll pay for lunch. I would give you a lunch at home. But if they're going to go get an ice cream afterwards, well, you go pay for your own ice cream. If they're going to go, you know, teenage girls, if you want to go get your nails done, have at it. But you're paying for that. You know?
Yeah.
And so then they start thinking, like, how does this add up? Like, it's like, okay, you know, dad will feed me. But all this other stuff, I have to, you know, they're seeing how quickly it adds up. And this today, we had these coupons, like discount coupons for the manicure. And so pretty clever, my daughter brought four of them in. Each for $5 because the manicure is $20. So she thought she could present all five of them and get a free manicure. But the manicure said, that's not how it works. We'll take one and you can come back. But she got $5 off. So I'm like, great. She's thinking in those terms because she has to figure out a way to pay for it. Because at the end of the day, I don't know, she doesn't get her nails done. Who cares? Doesn't matter.
Yep.
So like, if you want to do something that is enjoyable to you, increase your sense of however you feel about yourself, something it's really fun to do with one of her girlfriends, something like that, great. But find a way to pay for it. And you're old enough where there's plenty of babysitting jobs around where you can help and earn some money. At the core of everything we do at the company Dads, at the everything I did at the New York Times in my book, was a sense of personal honesty. And that is like the key thing. Like, and you know, as a journalist, I had super high integrity. I was always honest. But when I first was the lead dad as a journalist, I wasn't, because I was afraid to sort of come out and tell my friends that this is, you know, I was the go-to parent. And I regret that. But, you know, through regret comes growth. And so that's what I said. And, you know, you asked me about money. Money is the thing that requires the most honesty. I would give talks about that book. And I remember giving a talk years ago in Santiago, Chile. And I don't know why the book was so popular there. It blows my mind. It was not super popular in, like, in New York City for sure. And it was a gigantic group, thousands of people, probably the biggest audience I ever spoke to. And I asked people to raise their hands when I asked certain questions. And I would say, has anybody here ever had an argument with their spouse? Hands go up. Anybody here divorced? Hands go up. Anybody here have trouble with their children? Hands. Anybody here ever have, like, you know, serious concerns about their child's well-being, their mental health? Their, you know, hands go up. Anybody here ever have a serious disease? Cancer? Anybody have cancer? Yeah. Okay. Was it rough? Yeah. Anybody have, like, breast cancer, prostate cancer? Hands go up. And I said, thank you for being so honest and sharing all this stuff with me. One last question. Anybody here, I'm only going to call on one or two people. Could you just raise your hand and tell me how much money you have in your bank account? No hands go up. And so then I pause and I say, let's just talk about what you wanted. You would share with me. You would share with me, you know, intimate details about your relationship with your wife, details about your child and whatever he or she was struggling with. You would tell me about your health, not just your health. You would tell me about something as invasive as cancer in breast cancer, prostate cancer, but you won't tell me how much money you have. And let me ask you this. I wouldn't even know what that number meant. If you told me you had $1 million, I don't know what that means. You could be a janitor and it's somehow invested and saved and you have $1 million and you cannot imagine how much money you have and you have no concerns ever the rest of your life. Or you could have been somebody who had inherited $50 million and you squandered it and you're down to your last million. And I'd use that as a way to show people, like, you have to be honest about everything in your life, and somehow, like, not being truthful about that, it radiates out, and your kids will know that, people will know that, you know, as I say, like, and so that's, you know, at its core, it's always, you know, being honest with yourself and everything we do.
Yes, thank you. Coming back to the truth, the beautiful way to end this chat, Paul. How can people learn more about you? Where can they go to learn more about you and all your awesome stuff?
You know, all social media channels under Paul Sullivan, under the company Dads, or you can go to our website, which has a sort of omnibus collection of everything we've been doing over the past 2 years, and that's thecompanyofdads.com. So thecompanyofdads.com. Go there, check it out. sign up for our newsletter, The Dad, once a week. It'll keep you updated on what's happening.
Amazing. Paul, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Sonia, thank you for having me on. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thanks for joining the Chat About Children with Sonia Vestelich. www.chataboutchildren.com.